The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Pod Save the Pea was brought to you by HelloFresh. You may have heard of HelloFresh. They're the number one meal kit in America, making home cooking easier with chef-created recipes and fresh ingredients delivered straight to your door. But this fall, they're serving up even more to love. This isn't the HelloFresh you remember. If you can believe it, it's bigger. HelloFresh has doubled the menu. You can now choose from 100 options each week, including new seasonal dishes and recipes from around the world. Dig into bigger portions that'll keep everyone satisfied. It's healthier. Feel great with an even healthier menu. HelloFresh now helps you eat greener with new veggie-packed recipes that have two or more veggies per dish. And if you can believe it, it's tastier. Get steak and seafood recipes delivered every week for no extra cost, now with 3 times the seafood options. Savor the season with hearty fall recipes like classic beef chili or honey glazed pork tenderloin. Discover new seasonal produce each week, from leeks to broccolini to Italian eggplant and more. Now, I can't cook. I tried. I'm not very good at it. And I travel so much that the groceries thing is a mess and the food was going bad and da da. I'm a huge fan of HelloFresh. It's one of the ways that I make sure that I have a variety in my menu, that I actually like have balanced meals, and I can do a week to week. I don't have to like get locked into one menu for 4 months, and it's beautiful. I'm a huge fan. And now that there are more things on the menu, it's even better. The best way to cook just got better. Go to HelloFresh.com/people10FM now to get 10 free meals and free breakfast for life. One per box with active subscription. Free meals applied as discount on first box. New subscribers only. Varies by plan. That's HelloFresh.com/people10FM to get 10 free meals plus free breakfast for life. Hey, this is Dre. And welcome to Pod Save the People. On this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda back to talk about the news with regard to race, justice, and equity. And then I sit down with the incredible historian Bench Ansfield to talk about their new book, Born in Flames, The Business of Arson and the Remaking of the American City. The book revisits the wave of fires that tore through the Bronx and other American cities in the 1970s and challenges a story that many people were told. Here's the thing. I wasn't told any story. I read this book and was like, this is wild. I had no clue. Literally no clue what happened. Didn't know anything about who they blamed it on, what was true, not true. I think this will blow your mind. It blew my mind. Read the book, listen to the interview. Here we go. Last week on Runaway Country, Alex Wagner dug into the chaos at the Pentagon, joined by 3 incredible guests. First, former CIA analyst and Assistant Secretary of Defense, Senator Alyssa Slotkin. She joined to talk about her stance on both the boat strikes and Signalgate and how it's been in the crosshairs of the president and his allies. Then Ben Rhodes weighs in on the reputational damage and what it says about America on the world stage. Lastly, Nancy Youssef, one of the journalists who gave up her Pentagon press pass rather than bow to authoritarian rules, shares what it's like reporting from outside the walls while holding Hexeth accountable. It's a jam-packed must-listen episode. Tune into Runaway Country now on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. This is our last episode of 2025. It's been a long year. I'm excited for 2026. This is Dere at DRY on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson on Instagram at Sun Pulpit. I promise you I'm not changing again. That's it. Sun Pulpit. That's it. I'm done.
We went from moon to sun. My name is Sharonda Bossier. You can find me on LinkedIn at Bossier Shay on Instagram and at Bossier S on Spill.
Before we talk about politics, let's talk about MTV.
Yeah.
R.I.P.
I can't believe MTV is actually ending. When I saw that, I was like, oh, that's like a weird Onion article. And then I was like, wow, I never thought there'd be an end to MTV, the pioneers of that type of journalism and music videos, and I was shocked actually that it is that it's over.
Yeah, MTV breaking news with Kurt Loder. You know what I mean? You were like, just you were used to that kind of beaming in as you were watching music videos. When they did the like spinoff channels and you could get your like VH1 Soul, because it's all the same company, you know, that felt good. And then I think maybe just over the last decade, they struggled to kind of capture the cultural zeitgeist, right? Like they struggled to meet young people where they were. And they weren't keeping those of us who were part of the MTV generation checked in. I remember people going on Total Request Live and like how big a deal that was. You couldn't wait to see your favorite people on that. There's some iconic footage from the late 90s, early aughts from like just people doing wild stuff at the MTV Awards. For some people, it was like the first time they saw like two girls kiss each other was when Britney and Madonna kissed on stage. Like there was just like a whole host of things that happened that like if you weren't there, it's hard to explain how much of a cultural powerhouse MTV was. So a little sad to see it go, but I in some ways think they were victims of their own strategic missteps. And like, even as music videos have come back, I'm thinking about like even, you know, 10 or 15 years ago when Gaga was investing a ton in music videos or Beyonce investing a ton in music videos, there was really no place for them to go and nowhere for MTV to play them in their schedule. So, you know, people don't want to watch ridiculousness or reruns of The Hills over and over. Yeah. But still, sad to see it sunset.
Yeah, I think it was pretty obvious MTV was going downward even in my youth because of MTV relinquishing so much to the reality television pipeline. MTV and VH1, so many Viacom ran companies were relinquishing it to reality television. And to me, that is like the canary in the coal mine. Even if it looks successful at that moment and people are it's popular at that
Miles,
moment.
Are you a hater of it, Road Rules and Real World? They were the pioneers, young people.
But Come that's different than what they became, The Hills. Yeah.
I'm younger than that. So, Real World. not even being shady, but like Real World and Road Rules came out in the 90s. And those were two individual reality television programs that were Pioneers. Surrounded. But also surrounded by other types of programming.
Correct.
By the time I was 10, which was 2000.
You're so shady.
Time I was 9, 10 in the early 2000s, there was, it was a Laguna Beach, The Hills, Jersey Shore. There was the dating game. So there was a lot of these dating games that were answers to more adult dating games. Tequila. So there was a lot more.
All of those.
Yeah. See,
deeply problematic bisexual representations.
deeply. So like once you get to like that trash TV early 2000s, mid 2000s MTV, you can see that we're going down. Whereas you can see that the last vestige of relevance is that MTV Music Awards and stars like you just named Beyonce and Lady Gaga, who were still of that Michael Jackson, Prince era of creating art pieces through their music videos and making it relevant, because where else would you go? But I wrote for MTV in my career. I'm glad to say it. And last thing I want to say that's kind of connecting this, speaking of dead brands that are, to me, were just the pinnacle of places I wanted to see myself at as a kid, that Rolling Stone article about Taylor Swift and how it's coming out that whole article around Taylor Swift being... basically saying that all the Nazism accusations that Taylor Swift was receiving were all bots. So now it's being revealed that was a publicity ran article, but then that also the publicity company is also an AI company. So now she fed this problem to AI and it created an answer, and Rolling Stone published it in order to turn the wave of how she was being critiqued around. And again, when I did MTV, just being real, I have no problem with the artist who I talked about, but that was a PR article. Like I was commissioned to do a publicity article for MTV. And I was thinking, well, damn, I'm such a interesting, smart writer. And there's so many other interesting, smart writers to kind of defang me and just write a PR article shows you where MTV's going and it's not the cutting edge. And same with the Rolling Stone article. It's like, this could have actually been such a more interesting moment if we, I guess we weren't in this place in media where you can't really take those kind of risks because the artist is also the company controlling the publicity. So,
yeah, actually one more shout out to an MTV institution, Diary. Remember, like, you think you know, but you have no idea.
No idea.
This is the Diary of. I loved those. Yes.
Wow.
I think
I was heartbroken when I found out MTV Cribs was a scam. That really did mess me up. They were lying.
Look at Miles. Miles is like, now you know.
So how was I supposed to know?
So you thought somebody was sitting down and sleeping in a fish tank every night?
Shut up.
Like Missy Elliott?
Did you know Pimp My Ride was also a scam?
Did you know it was scam?
No, I was like, wow, this is the life of the rich and famous. And then, which was also another good show that my great grandmother watched, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous,
Robin Leach.
With Robin Leach. Oh, wow. Miles, do you remember that? Do you remember Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous?
I don't remember that, but I am a pop culture archivist, so I have seen and experienced it.
Okay. My favorite pop culture throwback reference was when you did, oh my God, what's her name? She's the Jamaican, who wasn't Jamaican.
Miss Cleo.
That was great. That was one of my favorite episodes of your cultural. You wrapped it all together in a way I was like, okay, you did that. I'm 10 out of 10 notes. So rest in peace, MTV. I also want to talk about, you all must have seen by now that Jasmine Crockett is running for U.S. Senate in the great state of Texas. There's been a lot of controversy about it. There have been people who have been super pumped and super proud of her. There have been people who have said that the Republicans have seeded this campaign, that they seeded the polls, that they really wanted her to run. There's been criticism about her position or what people believe to be her position on Israel or lack thereof, or Palestine. I'd love to know what you all think about Jasmine running.
So when I first saw the announcement, my first thought, and maybe I shouldn't admit this on the podcast, was like, oh, she looks good. And that matters so much for women, particularly Black women in the public eye. Like, she looked great. I wasn't quite sure how the leveraging of Trump talking about her would play with people, because I think there was a lot of, oh, I am those people's worst fears, which I think is like fine, but I feel like the base is really hungry for someone who will fight for something, not just be the anti-Trump. And I haven't quite yet gotten a sense of what her vision is. As anticipated, as predicted, as we all probably could have likely, I don't know, written ourselves if someone had pushed us to. We've seen a lot of anti-Blackness, a lot of sexism, a lot of misogynoir, where those two things intersect in response to her campaign, really not rooted in or focused on the issues, right? A lot of it has been about how people perceive her, how people perceive where she is rough around the edges, et cetera, et cetera. I do think that what's interesting is seeing some of the press and media coverage saying, you know, she says I a lot. She talks about herself a lot. And maybe that's actually what this political moment requires, right? This political moment might actually be a moment in which someone who centers the people too much and what they are talking about is not electable, particularly to statewide office. In some ways, you need someone to be in love with the candidate, almost to a point of some of their positions not mattering, right? I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. She did say something really smart, I thought, around the chances she has as a Democrat running for statewide office in Texas, right? She's like, everybody is telling us like it's impossible, blah, 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 but like we can shift that. And so I thought it was smart for her to name that early.
I think so many things fascinate me about Jasmine Crockett that did not fascinate me before she ran for Senate, if I'm being honest. Because I think a lot of different questions show up now that she's vying for even more power. And because she's operating in a way. So here's the thing. I think that Black people, so I'm big into interior design. I promise this is going to make sense. So I'm big into interior design in different people's houses. And what I'll notice is that when Black people do interior design for the houses, they have more portraits of other Black people, their families, of pop culture, and of themselves. It's almost like the Black people, we reinforce our images and our pop culture images more. And I think that Jasmine does that too. And I think that sometimes that could be misconstrued as a type of narcissism. But if you have a culture trying to disappear you, you got to put yourself on your phone screen. If you have a culture that's trying to disappear you or trying to shame you, you got to have the extra long nails that say resist and say, oh, I'm going to do both at the same time. And I know law, like that is a part of us creating visibility out of the invisibility we've been handled. And I think doing that in ways that are like ghetto fabulous is a part of our cultural tradition. So I think that's one thing. The other thing is me kind of reading these articles around Republicans seducing Jasmine with these polls and kind of reading more about how that's the thing that both Democrats and Republicans do. It's starting to make so much more sense. How come, like, again, you know, Vice President Harris, it felt so uneven. I'm like, well, when I log on, it feels like she's gonna win. But when I'm in the streets or when I'm talking to different people in different areas, it does not feel like that. And it's interesting to see the Republican Party kind of seduce who they think will be the person who will be easily beat, and thinking through those things. Like, last thing I'll say is even things with like Gavin Newsom coming out and saying that, like, oh, he's the front runner and stuff like that. I sit with a lot of doubt with that. I sit with a lot of doubt because Like, I find it hard to believe, and I find it hard to not be conspiratorial when we're just seeing these numbers and so much of course, my lived experience, but what I'm seeing culturally and just, and if honestly, just the gut that you cultivate after talking about culture for a minute and being like, this doesn't feel right. It feels like either people are being tricked or we're trying to be tricked into thinking these people are the front runners or these are the people that people like. And it's actually not that. And we're just going to get embarrassed when we run these candidates who don't actually have this support. And Jasmine's going to be an interesting science project of that too, of seeing how much of this is real. Is there more people coming out? Like, what actually happens?
Yeah, I'm interested in this. I do think you're right, Miles. I think a lot of people, one of the takeaways, mine as well, from Kamala was just the difference between what was happening online and what was happening in-person conversations. It was like night and day, two different races, two different countries, two different conversations. Like, that was very interesting. Also, you know, I had never thought about Jasmine in Israel before. And the fact that there is so much like a clear by her answer means that she has to just clear something up. Like the fact that both sides are having clips that sound sort of something. I think that the lesson for me from Kamala was if you don't take this seriously, it will bite you in the behind on the left. Like you got to take it. Kamala didn't take it seriously. She thought she could President Biden her way out of it. Yeah. And she couldn't. So I was actually surprised that Jasmine is even in a moment where people legitimately can say they don't know what she believes. Like that is sort of a, I was like, oh, that was sort of a weird, not lesson learned from the last moment. I also was surprised by her launch video. Sharonda was sort of like, I thought a lesson learned from Kamala was like, just being against Trump, not a motivator for people. Zohran, I think, is the great lesson of like, be against that man, but be for a lot of other things. And, you know, I went to McDonald's today, y'all. I just want to say this. Do you know how much a large fry at McDonald's? Do you know how much a large fry at McDonald's is?
$4.
Just a large fry. $4.19.
Yeah.
A Palestinian baby is how much a fry at McDonald's costs. Okay.
Do you remember $4 used to be a whole meal? Anyway.
Yeah.
But I was surprised that she... Now, with that said, the left has very few clear communicators. She is one of them. The left has very few people, I think, who people have seen be willing to fight and push back visibly and da-da-da. Like, she is one of them. I think that means something. But I also was sort of, I saw a news clip where they were like, you know, how are you gonna convert the Trump voters? And she was like, I think I can win without them. And I was like, I don't know if that's true in Texas. Like, I think you might need to get some of them. But I don't know, Miles, what you got?
So I maybe surprisingly, but I've been disagreeing with people who think that Jasmine's instincts right now are not on, because everybody's left in every state is different. And I know a lot of people in Texas. My aunt lives in Dallas. She works for Planned Parenthood in Dallas, so maybe I shouldn't. She has a leadership position there. I see so many people come out of Texas, and not unlike Georgia, there is a different practicality that comes out of the left inside of these southern states, because they are so intimate towards what's going on. Mm. It's not theoretical. It's not Cuomo versus Zoran, which is still these kind of like liberal left choices, even though one is corporatist and maybe not so left, and one is seen as like more socialist. It's like literally a Ku Klux Klan member or Jasmine. And I think that her just saying, "I'm anti this MAGA movement," actually does work well in Texas, will motivate people.
I don't know. I think that's not, I think that she's running against the guy on the left. It'd be different if there was no other candidate running in this race. She is not running.
She's got to win this primary.
Member. She's not running against a Klan member in the left. I don't think, I hear you though. I get it.
No, I'm not saying she's running against a Klan member on the left. I know, the hairless white boy who she's running against. Like, I get that, but I'm saying once that primary's done, who she'll be running against is somebody who most black Texans do not want. And I think that her galvanizing Texans in this way of saying I'm anti that is enough. I think I truly think that a lot of people, specifically when I think about Georgia and Texas and how they speak about things, they're like, no, we want these people out, and we want to know somebody's going to be oppositional to towards them.
This is not what you said about Kamala. This is literally the anti comment you said when you made a whole thing
because
about
Kamala is right. Because Kamala is running for the president of the United States, which means you have to have a nuanced and various and more diverse way of how you attack it. Texas is, do you want guns and you want somebody who's gonna help Donald Trump, or do you not? Same with Zoran. That's every place, every position should have a different campaign. So I don't know why we would compare what Jasmine's doing for Texas to what Kamala was trying to do for the whole United States.
We just disagree on this. I think it is a consistent argument to say that just running against Trump is not enough to win. And I don't think that's place-based, but we disagree. So, like, that's cool. I do think the internet is, like, a third place, though. And I think that Jasmine is... I don't think the strategy is winning on the internet. And now, whether that translates into real life or not, you know, we'll see. But I do worry about... And I was in a room with James, and I was... surprised at how well it works in the room. I've never seen Jasmine talk in a room, so I'm, you know, like, that matters. I'm interested to see what that feels like. I saw the James guy, and I was like, oh, this works. This, like, Christian sort of thing.
I do think if I were to, like, tell it, like, signal any type of advice to Jasmine in this moment, is for her to do interviews where she's able to, I guess, sure, address the, like, those more leftist global concerns. But have a better answer. But I also think Jasmine can really do some good work with... So, like, on the left, there's really no spaces to talk philosophically or spiritually or talk about, like, your narrative and your storytelling. Like, a lot of times, like, on the right, you'll go in there and you'll be somewhere for 4 hours and you will definitely talk politics, but you'll talk about your ideas on philosophy and your ideas on gender and your ideas on spirituality. And, of course, all of these things are, like, fascist and conservative ideas, but there's still those conversations. And I think that, like, in order for people to feel Jasmine, like, why, maybe we just don't have those type of interviewers, but, like, there are videos of Jasmine code switching and having a different voice. And I think that that is an opening for such a vulnerable conversation of how did you find your voice and stuff like that. And I think I wish I saw more of that with her so people can feel connected, because now she does feel like a mascot, though. Like, she does feel flat.
Yes. I was going to say that. I think this has definitely flattened her, and she has become one dimensional, and she is not. She is much fuller than that. You're right. Where do you go? It's like the Breakfast Club. Like, there are not a lot of places that I think their campaigns would send them. It is one of the things, especially because I, you know, because of the New York of it, Zohran is still doing Instagram like things with these people with like 5,000, 10,000 hits. I just saw he did a thing with this. There's like a kid who has a podcast. Like a this boy must be in first grade, maybe second grade. He interviews Zohran. He's like, "What's it like? What are you gonna do when you're mayor?" Like, and I'm like, Zohran, you are nailing this strategy of like staying with the people and being like a full person. And I had been.
I said that when he won. I said that when he won. I said, "Don't log off." And I knew. And I guess I intuitively knew because they were actually so smart. I was like, "That is just the beginning." Which y'all like, he's going to make sure that you never feel like, "Oh, we got him in the seat and got him elected, and he disappeared." You're gonna feel involved with it. That's why I was saying the thing about joking about the tattletale, because he has that kind of communication. You have to cultivate that and continue to be cultivated. That is what killed Kamala too, is that she kind of just disappeared once she did all the things where she should have took us on that journey and got us used to her.
She did. He is a model.
Have y'all heard of the diaper diplomacy?
I
didn't see that. Yeah. What I will say about Jasmine Crockett, in the interest of being fair, is I just looked up and she is beating Tallarico in the latest poll. I think it's like 51-40 something, but she is up. And that is good for Jasmine.
The other reason why I think what she did was smart is, even when I see diaper diplomacy, and you know I love woke Katy Perry, you know I love Taylor Lorenz down, but I saw Taylor Lorenz critique Jasmine Crockett for using AI, and I see so many people critiquing Jasmine Crockett for using AI and using this kind of like viral AI slop diaper diplomacy aesthetic to get some of her messaging out. But I think that is what a huge group of her supporters and that Democratic base is. The Democratic base isn't the far left. It's not anarchists. It's not Black feminists. It's those kind of neoliberal, the View watching, I hate Trumpers, and they watch stuff like that, and they want, and they feel activated, and that is enough for them, you know. And I think that's how Cumbie's smart too, because she's kind of going over a group of people, of leftists, who you probably won't be able to satisfy in stuff. And she's kind of doing, to me, what to your point, Kamala Harris couldn't do, because she was running for a different position, where I'm like, oh, you could actually do that with, from what I've seen from the culture of Texas, you could actually get away with running like that. And I think her choices are showing that they're not dumb choices for where she's at and the cult and the people she's serving.
And in some ways, your critique could be leveled to Kamala, that, like, you know, if it wasn't a campaign that felt so run by consultants and trying to get this group of people that frankly probably would have supported her anyway, she could have actually done some really interesting things that would have opened up, or she could have not done things like Meg the Stallion. She could have shied away from some things that were just going to lose her some people. Is a TSU poll. Crockett polls highest with Black women, 92%, Black men, 84%. And Latino women, 49%, and lowest among white women, 45%, Latino men, 33%, and white men, 32%. It's 51% to 43% her in Tallarico.
Chelsea Handler needs to do her big one. Like, I can't stand it, though. The white, whatever it is, that white mom, the white wine moms, like, oh, those, yeah. Like, a lot of the white women, people in the zeitgeist need to do their big one and help her. But I think that what's interesting is, a lot of times the things that smartly and cleverly Jasmine is using are things that are already seen as Black and dumb. So I think that people see what she's doing and thinking that she's dumb, but then the results are showing that no, she actually just knows who she's talking to. And she's really not talking to the smartest leftists on the internet. She's talking to a working 49-year-old who is tired of this Trump nonsense and wants to alleviate that pain.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, the holidays is a time of tradition. There are all these things that you probably do with the people you love and the people that love you around the holidays. I always go to my sister's house with the kids. My father comes. It's a thing. We've been doing it forever. We're always together around Christmas. Now, what if you make some new traditions for the holidays? One of them being therapy. That how we reflect on the past year, how we think about the ups and downs, the in-betweens,
All of that should be a tradition too. And the cool thing is that you don't have to do it alone. I'll tell you, I went through a lot this year. So many highs. Some rough moments as well. But the good thing is I didn't have to do any of it alone. Not only do I have incredible friends and family, but therapy is a game changer. I did not realize or appreciate before I went to therapy how important it was to have somebody not in your day-to-day life to talk to. Now, BetterHelp is great because it's the world's largest online therapy platform. There are 30,000 therapists. If you want to switch therapists at any time, you can do it. They've been in the game for a long time, over 12 years of experience and over 1.7 million client reviews with an average rating of 4.9. And they've helped over 5 million people globally. And now they can help you. This December, start a new tradition by taking care of you. Our listeners get 10% off at betterhelp.com/people. That's betterhelp.com/people. Let's jump into the news. My news is about the ICC, the International Criminal Court. And I was going through the news this week, and I definitely missed this. If not for the pod, I would not have known that President Donald Trump wants to make sure that the ICC amends its founding document so that they will never investigate Donald Trump now or when he leaves office or his top officials. They also want to make sure that the ICC drops investigations of Israeli leaders over Gaza, and they want the International Criminal Court to formally end any probes of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Now, the ICC, you know, already doesn't have full jurisdiction over things related to the United States, and you might famously know that the International Criminal Court did issue arrest warrants for Netanyahu, for the former Israeli defense chief, and a Hamas leader. So that has been a thing. And, you know, it is, I saw this and I was just really surprised by it, actually. There are 125 member states in the ICC, and it excludes the major powers like China, Russia, and the United States, but has wide jurisdiction to over citizens in general. So they're worried about what happens when Trump leaves the White House. And I bring it here because it's just a reminder that they know what they're doing. They know they're breaking all types of laws, norms. Like, they know this is a war crime. Like, there's not a moment where you're like, oh, no, they think they're doing the right thing. It's not. That's not this. They know they are wrong. And they are all freaking out to make sure that when Trump dies or leaves or whatever, that they all don't get hauled into any version of an accountability mechanism that we have. And I don't know if I have anything deeper to say here besides, again, it showed me that they know what they're doing and that structurally they're trying to make sure that nobody is held accountable here or elsewhere. Yeah, so I brought it just so I didn't know if y'all had seen this.
I had not seen it. I think it's also a strategy that they've deployed domestically, though. I think that's why they have so many cases pending in front of the Supreme Court, because they know that what they are doing is not allowable. And so they're like, just like, if you change the rules so that what we want to do is legal and allowable. I find, though, their fear of the International Criminal Court, quite frankly, to be a little funny. I don't have another word for it, because I think the ICC has really demonstrated that if you are a leader of one of the sort of powerful countries in the world, rarely do we come after you and rarely do you actually experience any real consequence. I think the sort of most highly visible set of like international trials or tribunals were, you know, happened in the wake of World War II. The Nuremberg trials, like some of the folks who were architects and orchestrators of the Holocaust. But even a lot of people who were lower rank and participated in that got resettled in the U.S., you know? So like, there's just like, there's, in some ways I'm like, you were never going to be who the ICC targeted. You are not a black or brown person leading a quote unquote third world, you know, regime or country where they are going to call your regime a military junta. You know what I mean? Like that you're not who they're targeting. So I'm not quite clear what they're fearful of, to be honest with you. But maybe that's my naivete. Somebody listening will know better.
Yeah. And maybe, yeah, I think I'm on the same side as you, Sharonda, on this. Is that, to me, when I read it, it felt like a So things can feel really big to us because we're on the receiving ends of it, because we're in the society that they are manipulating. But I kind of just feel like it was just their retirement plan. Like, it's just like crossing their T's. Like, it's like just like somebody might do like insurance or do something with housing or making sure you have a different types of like money coming in once you retire. It kind of felt like they were just making sure, well, let's make sure that this doesn't become an inconvenience and let's just use our power to ensure that this won't get out of control. But I don't know if I'm buying that this was as big of a move for them as it is for us viewing it and making it news, is I guess what I'm trying to say.
That's interesting. I do think like trying to stop the investigations of the other people seems like a big deal too. Like you can't investigate the war crimes that the US troops did in Afghanistan. You can't investigate the Israeli people for what they've done in Gaza. So maybe they are just using Trump as a front, like so that becomes the news. But really what they really want is to make sure that none of the other sergeants and generals, so I'm sure raped and pillaged all these people and killed all these people, that nobody will ever hold them accountable.
Yeah.
Another thing to add to the list to watch.
Well, in that same vein of like what's allowed under the law, what's extrajudicial killings and murder, et cetera, we've talked on the pod a couple of times about the U.S. blowing up ships and boats in the Caribbean. And to date, the U.S. has blown up more than 20 boats or ships and has killed more than 80 people in those strikes. The Trump administration's official position is that they are preventing drug smugglers from making it to the U.S. This is sort of a preemptive strike. And, you know, legal experts, including former military lawyers, are saying that y'all are killing civilians who've not been accused of anything, who are not, you know, facing trial, who've not been convicted of anything, right? And this is unlawful and it amounts to murder. And so increasingly, some U.S. service members who have been part of these strikes are reaching out, seeking legal advice of their own to figure out if they could face personal legal consequences for their actions, right? I also think that this speaks to people understanding that this administration is out for itself, right? And that if this administration needs to sacrifice anyone so that the international community feels like it's gotten its justice, it's likely going to be a rank and file member of the military. And so I just find this moment really interesting where people are like, I understand that I have sworn a duty to uphold the Constitution and to serve the President of the United States as my commander in chief. And I think that what's happening here might be wrong. If I've participated, what are the likely personal legal consequences for me? And I wanted to bring it to the pod for that reason. I think it also kind of builds on some of the themes that DeRay's news this week raises for us.
I hope the International Criminal Court is reading this news too. Get these people, you know, get round all of them up. I don't know, you know, Trump, I think is hoodwinking, you know, he don't care about these people. He don't even know who he pardoning, and whoever is doing the pardons over there certainly is not checking for these people who, when anybody sane takes over the DOJ again, all these people going to get in trouble. You know, hopefully that day comes. But I'm surprised at the not riders for Trump who are continuing to support this stuff. I don't know. Like, I think about all the beard ban, I think like firing all the black people, kicking the trans people out, changing the books, like, you know, people with medical conditions that are completely fine to be in the military, getting all them out. You know, it seems like the OG military people have to be like, this don't make no sense. You know, like the Joint Chiefs fire those people. What Hegseth is doing over at the FBI, getting rid of everybody. You're like, the intelligence community, you guys, even are conservative, but this feels like even a stretch. But anyway, I just think about the people blowing up the boats as a small group of people in this administration who should be held criminally liable when this is over.
You're making me question if I understood the article correctly, because I felt like I was also reading about people kind of having maybe like even like moral dilemmas around those actions.
For sure.
So what kind of like makes me a little sick around the military and the idea of the military? And I know that it's like normal in our society, and I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, but like, it's just, the fact that we outsource our moral evaluations to somebody else it still feels weird. Like, even the idea of, like, I'm going back to, like, the National Guard in my, like, imagination. The fact that, like, actually there is not a whole group of people who said, oh, I'm not doing this. I'm quitting this. I don't want to do this. Like, that actually, like, scares me a little bit. And again, it might be because I've been reading Culting of America, which everybody should read. But it really puts fear in me that you have to ask somebody else what is the moral around killing somebody, mm-hmm. like another human being. Like, that should be clear. The fact that you need somebody else to be in between that just feels odd to me. It just feels weird. And I know we're in a place where violence and protection are intertwined and we feel like we need that, but even that feels weird. Like, that was you did a wrong thing. And hopefully that wrong thing is an illegal thing and justice should happen because you did that. Yeah. You should have said, you should have quit.
Yeah. I mean, I think this raises the question, like, does the state have a right to kill? And if so, under what circumstances, right? And I think increasingly many of us are coming to the belief that the state doesn't have a right to kill, right? To take life.
I guess what frustrates me about America is that was already established by your own and a nation under God. We're a Christian nation. Mm-hmm. Everybody need the Bible, right? So we already established that is wrong. We already established that is not how we shouldn't do those things because of y'all's own doing. So now we're here. Now that we're here, it's like now we have to pretend and see what the legal loophole. Like, no, that's wrong, and you know that is wrong.
Yeah,
feels weird. Feels strange.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
This podcast is supported by Defending Our Neighbors Fund. Across the country, immigrants are facing family separation, wrongful detention, and deportation without due process or access to legal support. In 2024 alone, there were more than 2.5 million immigration court cases without legal representation. That means millions of people were denied the basic protection we expect from our justice system, the right to a fair process. Powered by people like you, the Defending Our Neighbors Fund is providing access to life-saving legal aid to families in crisis. But they urgently need your help to meet unprecedented demand. The government is pouring billions of taxpayer dollars into enforcement while slashing funding for legal aid. That makes your support more urgent than ever. Help defend your neighbors and keep families together. Donate now at defendingourneighbors.org/fund.
So I'm bringing good news. I'm bringing good news. So this is coming from a nonprofit by the name of Rainbow Serpent. They are specific when it comes to Black LGBT issues and art and culture, and they have a lot of cool programming and exhibits that they do. And one thing that I found is this documentary that's available on YouTube for free called Miracles, the Red Family Art Collection. And it's about this family who, hear this, it was the first Black art gallery in Macon, Georgia. I'm going to read a little bit from TubmanMuseum.com about this family. In 1990, Mel and Vernon Red opened Miracles Fine Art Gallery in Macon, the city's first fine art gallery dedicated to Black art. For 6 years, it served as a cultural hub, showcasing Black artists and fostering appreciation for their work in the middle of Georgia. In 1996, health challenges forced the gallery to close, and for over 2 decades, the collection remained in storage. Now, in the long-awaited revival, this exhibition brings these treasured works back into the public eye, reaffirming the family's enduring commitment to preserving Black cultural heritage. It goes on to say, more than just an art exhibition, Miracles is a testament to survival, resilience, and revival. So the documentary is so good because it not only talks to the founders, but it also talks to their children and who are grown, who are also in the arts. And also to me, because y'all know I'm like, I kind of just completed my first year in Ohio. And I think one of the bigger reasons why I wanted to leave Brooklyn and why I wanted to leave New York, at least for a moment, was because of it feeling like the things that were happening there were isolated there. And it feels like the actual risk that is of the moment wasn't happening. And I feel like this is such a good example of what the actual risk looks like, which is going into Macon, Georgia and creating an art cultural hub of Black art that centers Black art and Black culture and is a meeting place for Black minds. That is what the risk actually looks like, because that's where the change is really needed. There's not really, don't don't get me, but I don't think if California or specifically like LA or if New York or DC never had another black thing again, a black excellent thing again, I think that they would still have an abundance of things. Whereas I think there are so many places bereft of that who do not have any of that. And I think these people were such a good example of how it does not take all the millions of dollars. They were still working their regular jobs. They had children. The children have beautiful pictures of themselves against this black art with these black artists that, and not to mention the some of the art they have. I'm talking like Ernie Barnes, Jacob Lawrence. They just have some like beautiful sculptural pieces. I believe they even have like either some portraits or some sculptures of Augusta Savage, a sculptor I talked about before, black women sculptor that I talked about before on this podcast. But they have so much stuff that that just infused that community with culture and with purpose and with possibility. And again, it was a way to keep money inside of the black community. So you have artists who are able to show their work there and get it bought. But then you also have black people who are able to, hey, I have, you know, that kind of $5,000, $10,000 to $15,000, that kind of the meat of the real art community. We kind of hear about the $300 million purchases, but that kind of like person who can afford that $10,000 painting or that $15,000 painting, that is who we need to be able to get to put more money into black artists. And the fact that there was a hub to do that kind of economic exchange was really inspiring and made me feel like, oh wow, this affirms the possibilities that I'm seeing in my mind of like, okay, these things can't just exist in these coastal elite spaces. They have to exist in places that don't have any, that people have forgotten about or people have said are useless or can't be changed. And not to wrap this up with Jasmine Crockett once again, but I think to me, what they did culturally and artistically is what a Jasmine Crockett would have to do politically, is saying, oh, Texas is red, forget about Texas. That has not been a good strategy. So I think even when it comes to culture and art and getting people in a society to think more cutting edge and to update their beliefs and stuff, you have to go to these places that are seen as conservative and a lost cause and update those places with art and with cultural hubs. And I think this was such a cool blueprint. And again, the documentary is free on YouTube. You can watch it, support it. It looks like a really cool nonprofit. I did my Googles to make sure there wasn't no embezzlement or anything, child. No money laundering. So I can endorse it and say that it looks really cool. And I think it'll be something really beautiful to watch while you're enjoying your Christmas or your Kwanzaa or your Hanukkah.
I appreciated seeing the photos and videos of the family, actually. And I felt like the matriarchs were wearing dresses that I could almost feel against my face. I don't know how else to explain it, right? Like I could feel walking behind my grandmother, right? I could smell walking behind my Auntie Dawn. There's something about seeing black people who look like regular black people moving and living and breathing and building this thing that felt so comforting to me. So, you know, I'm grateful that this has become one of your segments on the podcast, because again, it just opens up portals to new worlds for me, but also familiar ones.
You know, we've talked a lot, we as in society, not even the podcast, have talked about a lot about the end of third spaces, that there are just aren't places, you know, it's like people talk about the bowling alley a lot, but I think about there are these really cool third spaces that still exist that people don't go to. As we're planning Campaign Zero for Black History Month, and we're looking at like archives that exist, museums that are around, art spaces that are around that like people just haven't been to in a while or haven't thought of, or that we went to on field trips when we were little kids, but they're like actually cooler now. We actually can appreciate the art because we're a little bit older, you know? And this just reminded me of like, that I think we might have been having an incomplete conversation when we talk about the lack of third spaces, that there actually are these really interesting spaces that are doing really cool things, that you can meet interesting people who are values aligned almost by virtue of the space itself. And I want us to pay attention to that. It even, to me, calls me to think about in my organizing, how can we partner with some of these places? Because, you know, so many places, you just need to get in one time. Like, if you get people there, they'll be like, oh, this is cool. But they just might not go on their own the first time, right? So how can we actually invite people into spaces or use them to throw events or talks and that are a little off the beaten path? So that is my push.
What you just said just had really just got me thinking about different things as far as just how we all can be of service to that. Like since being in Ohio and being in different like organizations, being able to use like digital consulting and just other things that I've learned being in New York and just having the career that I've had so far of like, oh, here's a way to cut through the noise, you know, because there's so many places that, to your point, are these amazing places, but maybe don't know how to update how they're reaching people and letting people know about them. So in this kind of viral internet community, they kind of get suppressed or they don't really cut through in helping people cut through. So I think we all have, anybody listening to this, everybody in society, I think we all have different resources we can lend in order to make sure these places stay in our like collective consciousness so we can continue to support them.
As we close, would love to know what you guys are looking forward to in 2026. Is anything on your mind as we think about the end of 2025 and the beginning soon of 2026?
I'm looking forward to fully leaning into my role as the resident auntie on the podcast. It's been really fun to spend time with you guys in this way and to stretch myself and be pushed in my own thinking. I'm also looking forward to hopefully more time in community. I think one of the things that I'm taking away from our conversations is the need to continue to build relationships outside of my existing friend circle, to open up my home to more conversations and more people about what's happening in real life, because I do think all of us are hungry for that. And I have the space and the capacity and the resources to do it. And so looking forward to sharing updates on how that stuff goes in my new real life.
Okay, let me know, because I want to come to Cali and have a salon at Sharonda's house. That sounds a Sharonda salon. Yeah.
Yes.
I want to be involved in that. I think I'm most excited as it pertains to like the podcast for 2026 is I'm continuing to kind of just challenge myself to look for even more things in publications and ideas and cultural hubs and these different like kind of Black cultural artifacts to present as possibility models, specifically now when people feel, because of the political moment, feel like more in like dire restraints. I love being able to supply like, no, we were This is what some Black people were doing during the crack era. This is what some Black people were doing during this era. Or this is what some Black people, again, to DeRay's point earlier, are doing right now and that we just don't know. So that exploration has made me feel really, really, really useful. And to Sharonda's point, like I've gotten some opportunities to like collaborate with different institutions where I live and to do different work. So just taking the artistic, cultural obsessions of mine and giving it to these different places in the Midwest that I see that there's not a whole bunch of that. So that's what I look forward in 2026.
I am really just trying to get through next Friday, everybody. And to get some time, I feel like I'm so busy that I have not had a chance to like dream in a while. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that is sort of what I want to do in the transition to 2026 is like dream again. And I'm proud of that. We did some really cool things in 2025 that I'm like, oh my God, I didn't think we could pull this off. We pulled it off. And I'm looking forward to time to dream. Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come. This podcast is sponsored by the Obama Foundation. The Obama Foundation is helping to lift up emerging leaders with the tools, training, and support they need to meet this moment in history. At a time when democracy feels under pressure, the Obama Foundation is investing in the next generation of leaders. These young changemakers are stepping up in communities around the world, turning ideas into action and challenges into solutions. The Obama Foundation believes that leadership is not about one person. It's about building movements, fostering collaboration, and creating lasting impact. Through programs, mentorship, and community engagement, the foundation equips young leaders with the skills and tools they need to tackle today's toughest challenges, from civic engagement to education, social justice, and climate action. Hope isn't passive, it's hard work. And the Obama Foundation is giving emerging leaders the resources they need to turn hope into meaningful change. Because when we empower people to lead, we unlock the future. You can help. Donate today by visiting obama.org/youth. That's obama.org/youth.
On today's show, I'm talking with historian Bench Ansfield about their new book, Born in Flames, The Business of Arson and the Remaking of the American City. The book revisits the wave of fires that tore through the Bronx and other American cities in the 1970s and challenges the story many of us were told about who was responsible. I learned a ton in this book. I didn't know any of this stuff before I read this book. I think you will be as fascinated by it as I was. Here we go. Bench, it is amazing to meet you. And this was such a beautiful book. And I feel like I know a lot around race and justice. And I knew none of this. I have so many questions. And it is an honor to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much, DeRay. It's an honor to be here. I'm excited to get into it with you.
Well, let's start with how did you, before we get to fire, how did you even learn about this topic? Did you always know you were going to write a book like this? Like, I don't know. Tell me how you got here.
Yeah, no, I was first kind of put on to this history by a neighbor of mine in Philly. I moved to Philly right after graduating college. Also thought I knew a thing or two, but my neighbor basically was like, look, like this thing happened. Landlords in mass burned down their buildings in the Bronx. And what kind of occasioned the conversation was that we were talking about the MOVE bombing in Philly in 1985. Mm. And she was like, well, this wasn't just here. This was also, you know, happening in the Bronx. And I remember just being like, what? You know, like, and I didn't really start looking into it for a number of years. The question just kind of like lodged itself in the back of my mind. But then eventually it kind of got too heavy, it became too much of a burning question. And I started to follow the money and see what I could find. And I was just totally astonished at what I came upon, that yes, indeed, this was a massive, widespread phenomenon, not only in the Bronx and cities across the country, including in Philly. It took me, 10 years to collect the research that eventually became this book. And a lot of the reason for that, the length of that gestation period, is that the only people who really had remembered this were the people who lived through this history, right? Historians were getting it wrong. Mm-hmm. Politicians, pundits were getting it wrong. So it took a long time to kind of piece together what actually was really happening.
So let's zoom out. So I start reading it and I'm like, up to 20% of the Bronx was burned. It just blew my mind. So can you just, for people who have not had the pleasure of reading the book yet, tell us the top line of the scope of arson and then why it matters?
Yeah. So in the Bronx, roughly 100,000 units of housing were lost over the course of about a decade, which is equivalent to like a city like New Haven, Connecticut, burning down in its entirety twice, right? And actually, this wasn't all just landlord arson. There were different sources of the fires, and also some of this was just landlords abandoning their buildings. But the most destructive fires were set by landlords. And in general, landlords' disinvestment from their buildings was kind of the catalytic factor, the precipitating factor that set, these buildings on their road to ruin. And, the story is about bad landlords, of course, but even more so, it's a story about insurance and the kind of inner workings of insurance in our cities and in our lives. And I should stop here and just like acknowledge that, for folks listening to this, just the mention of the I word, it can get people to freeze up, right? Nobody wants to talk about insurance. Like, it's the most stressful, soul-sucking thing. You literally buy insurance so that you don't have to think about it. Like, that's the business model. But the more I read about it, the more I started to see that, it's everywhere. It's this kind of hidden infrastructure of finance that shapes all sorts of, shapes our lives, shapes our landscapes in all these different ways. And that's really what ended up, pulling me in. It's like insurance pretends that it's really boring, but actually it is like, it offers this window into how capitalism works, right? It, not just how capitalism works, but actually how capitalism like the emotional logic of capitalism in a given moment, right? It's like a mood ring for capitalism. It shows it all on the surface, right? Like the fear, the greed, the anxieties, it's all there turning those emotions into dollars and cents.
So, you know, it's funny. I'm reading the book and my first aha is like, I can't believe they burned down so much in the Bronx. This is wild. And I can't believe this happened, not just in the Bronx, but in other cities, that there was an incentive to do this. So that's my first. I'm like, I had no clue. So I'm in between meetings the other day and I'm telling people, I'm like, did you know they burned down? Da-da. And then I keep reading. And I'm like, I've had this moment where I'm like, I actually didn't remember a world before insurance. Mm. Like I didn't even think about a world before fire insurance or homeowners insurance. Like I sort of have always thought about them as like, they just have always been around. And then I read this and I'm like, oh no, they have not always been around. Yeah. And that it is a racialized coming of insurance. Can you tell us like, what was the, can you help the listeners understand like what was the incentive for landlords to burn so much of the property? And then again, like so many beautiful moments in the book, and then public housing like remains unscathed, mm-hmm. is not burned down, is resistant to this. Can you help us understand the incentive structure for landlords in the Bronx to commit so much arson?
Yeah. So this really, you know, blew my mind, and I had to train myself in how the industry works in order to piece this together, because it has a lot to do with how insurance redlining has shaped our cities, the metropolitan regions since the 1940s. And, you know, redlining is in 2025, like most people hopefully are at least familiar with the term. Most of my students who come into my classrooms, even as freshmen, they will have some familiarity with redlining. But when people talk about redlining, usually they're talking about mortgage redlining. Like that's the kind of hidden assumption there. Insurance redlining was actually a different animal, right? And it played a role in how mortgage redlining worked, except like we know nothing about it, right? And this is again part of like, you know, not overlooking insurance overall, you know, and not kind of subjecting it to our analytic gaze the same way that we do other aspects of our economies. So insurance redlining began actually later than mortgage redlining. It began in the late 1940s, and it continued for the next two decades, really until the 1960s, when the uprisings of that decade basically accelerated it so much that the insurance market in American cities just kind of dried up almost entirely, right? Insurers were in what I call a racialized panic, right? The dollar losses from the uprisings of the 1960s weren't actually that high compared to like a natural disaster, for instance. But insurers were just totally convinced that unremitting Black revolt would continue to shape American cities forever, essentially. So they just fled. And President Lyndon Johnson at the time in 1967 basically realized that they had a major insurance crisis on their hands, right? Because even like government agencies were losing their own insurance, right? In Philadelphia, where I'm speaking from, the school district, the housing authority, they themselves had their insurance get canceled. So LBJ convenes a commission to study this. And it's actually kind of an offshoot of the much more famous Kerner Commission. And what that commission ends up doing is they propose something called the FAIR Plan, which stands for Fair Access to Insurance Requirements. And this was a kind of public-private insurance program that was designed to be an anti-redlining measure. It was designed to be a racial justice remedy, right? A way to correct for the redlining that had deprived Black and brown neighborhoods of insurance for these previous decades. But what the FAIR Plans introduced was actually still pretty crappy insurance. So beginning in 1968, states across the country introduced these FAIR Plans. And this was what you can kind of roughly think of as subprime insurance. It was so expensive and it delivered really shoddy protection. And this sort of FAIR Plan expansion occurred alongside ongoing redlining by banks and mortgage lenders. It occurred alongside all of the cutbacks and the austerity and the disinvestment that happened in American cities in the 1970s. And what that meant is that landlords were in a position where when they kind of measured the potential profits they could make through renting their buildings and getting equity in their buildings and eventually selling their buildings versus the amount of money they could make just by burning their buildings and collecting those FAIR Plan insurance claims, a good portion of them opted to burn their buildings, right? They were making an economic decision. They were heinous decisions, but they were making economic decisions. They were acting in accordance with these market principles. And that's kind of what drove this in the Bronx and across American cities.
So again, I'm reading and I'm like, I knew the Kerner Commission and the report was progressive in some ways, even today. Mm-hmm. It was wildly progressive then. And today you read it, you're like, you know, the government wouldn't even say those things today.
Yeah.
And then you talk about Hughes, who leads the commission that creates the FAIR Act. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, this was not very progressive. And such a good example of how people do these big structural things that sort of go without anybody paying attention to it. And it reshapes whole communities' lives. It really did just blow my mind. You know, I don't want to give away some of your coolest stories. So I'll just ask you. There were stories that stuck with me, but, you know, I don't want to give them all away. Is there like a story of a landlord that like still sticks with you from the book? Because one of the things I thought you did that was so well that I didn't even think about was sort of this argument about why the Bronx, why it was easy to do there. And this confluence of like the just racist redlining and all that stuff, but just racism in and of itself, that people didn't think of landlord, like they weren't the suspects, you know, like mm-hmm. When you get all these black and brown people, people just assume that the arsonists are like bad black kids or yes. bad Latino kids. Yep. And it was the landlords.
Yeah. Totally. So that was kind of like the big myth that this project is trying to debunk, right? Is that the fires of the 1970s were just, you know, quote, people burning down their own neighborhoods, right? Which is actually a narrative residue from those rebellions of the 1960s and into the early 70s, right? And there's a real tendency in popular memory and even in what historians write to allow for the kind of intense brightness and radiance of the 1960s uprisings, right? Which are so powerful, right? Such a powerful force in American history, you know, through today, that kind of intense brightness works to obscure the more destructive wave of landlord arson into the 1970s, right? And it's not just a matter of historical memory. During the 1970s, it was actually common among policymakers, especially policymakers in the Nixon orbit, right? Now it's Nixon is president. He takes over from LBJ to blame the rising fire rate on vandalism, on they're often kind of using these terms of riots and pyromania and vandalism. And this is a move that Daniel Patrick Moynihan makes famous in this memo that he writes to Richard Nixon in 1970 called the Benign Neglect Memo. And that tendency to blame tenants, to blame residents for the torching of their own neighborhoods could take, you know, all sorts of different valences. Some of these were sexualized. Criminologists believed that homosexuality was an indicator of pyromania. There's all these different ways where, you know, fire really lends itself to this sort of scapegoating, right? And to come back to your like an initial question, landlords were wise to this. So I actually begin the book with a landlord who wears blackface before going, dresses himself in blackface before going to torch one of his buildings, which was, you know, kind of exactly, you know, that's not actually a move that most landlords even had to do. They actually found more cunning ways to kind of redirect blame onto their tenants. But it's really emblematic of what landlords in general are trying to do, which is, you know, to kind of invert the causality, right? To redirect blame onto the people who are victimized by this process, right? And so the kind of master myth that the book is trying to take on is that this is just tenants burning down their buildings. And that tendency to just blame tenants is evident even today in all sorts of different ways, right? Landlords can in all different spheres blame their tenants four processes that they themselves set in motion, right? And it's tenants who, in the end, really take on most of the risk and the pain from that sort of discursive and narrative move.
That was a story that I was like, I love that he gets pulled over for a taillight. Mm-hmm. And they thought he was black. I'm like, I love it. See, this is what you get for being shady, you know, and being in blackface.
Yeah, exactly. Again, it's like he's wearing blackface, but the kind of, you know, lesson to pull from that is that actually what most landlords were doing is they didn't need blackface. They used financial masquerade, right? They found other ways. I call it briefcase minstrelsy. They found other ways to kind of shrug off any culpability and to push it onto to the residents of these neighborhoods. And actually the biggest way to do that was simply by hiring what they called torches to do the burning for them. Torches were usually young men or boys who lived in the targeted areas, right? Sometimes in the building itself. Sometimes these were like, you know, like 13-year-olds. They would get paid like sometimes as little as like 10 or 20 bucks to burn down a building. And because of the way that arson laws worked in the 1970s, it was exceedingly difficult to incriminate anybody but the person who literally struck the match. And so landlords could really insulate themselves from prosecution simply by commissioning somebody else to light the fires for them.
Can you help us understand the toll on communities? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm shocked by the fact this happening. Then I'm shocked because who knew insurance was, I mean, I knew the history of insurance as a concept was racist.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I didn't even know fire insurance was a thing. It wasn't a world before fire insurance. But can you talk about the impact on the Bronx or on families and communities? And as you started to talk at the very beginning of our conversation about the people who know this story, the best of the people who experienced it.
Yeah, of course. So it's kind of like impossible to overstate just how much these blazes, this firestorm terrorized the communities in the path of the blazes, right? The fires actually moved in somewhat predictable patterns. And this is especially true in the Bronx, where they spread gradually northward from the southern reaches of the borough. And in a way, they were, you know, you could actually watch them engulf block after block. And because these patterns were so discernible, even to the naked eye, right? Fires produce smoke, like, right? They're not, this isn't a hidden violence. You could see them coming, sometimes years ahead of time. You can watch them from, you know, miles away from the mid Bronx, from what was, you know, previously parts of the North Bronx getting kind of eaten up by this wave of arson. And so tenants watching this had to be really vigilant. Like they had to cultivate what I think of as this bruising vigilance just in order to stay alive. And the kind of the most damning detail or kind of the most tragic detail, the one that I couldn't shake when I first started encountering it in the archive, and I can't tell you how many times it came up, was parents putting their children to bed wearing shoes or wearing street clothes, right? Like ready to jump up and escape their apartment as fast as possible. Families would keep suitcases packed by the door. Just trying to imagine that sort of vigilance and maintaining it for years, right? That's what it took to stay alive. It actually breaks you when you really take in that detail. And most did stay alive. So considering that in the Bronx, there were 30 fires every night on average.
That is
it's crazy,
wild.
Right? It's beyond comprehension. And yet there were fewer deaths than those numbers would suggest. And part of that is that landlords typically weren't actually trying to kill anybody, right? They were trying to make money. And actually, if anybody died, it increased the amount of scrutiny that the fire would attract, right? So they found ways to tip off tenants. They would slide notes under tenants' doors in the middle of the night. They, you know, the super would kind of spread it, you know, spread news like a rumor. And this was life-saving gossip that actually, you know, is one of the reasons, one of the ways that like people kept each other safe, right? And just to, before I forget this other point that you made earlier, the only safe place to be was public housing. So This was like the data point that convinced me that this history had, you know, this project had legs, right? The fact that public housing, which is usually vilified in this era, right? We think of the 1970s as kind of the beginning of the end for public housing. By this point, it's deemed a failure and the federal government turns against it. It refuses to build more public housing. It begins to tear down public housing. And that process of gradually deconstructing this huge housing initiative that had since the 1930s created these hundreds of thousands of units across the country. That whole narrative of public housing being a failure is totally contradicted by this finding that actually the only safe place to be in the 1970s Bronx was a housing project owned by the state, right? That is so against the kind of common assumptions of how dangerous, supposedly dangerous public housing was in these years, that it really forces us to rethink, you know, what model of housing is actually most effective, right? What would it really mean to take seriously this finding that public housing was immune to these profit incentivized fires? And I think it really should change the calculus of where public housing belongs in our present cities.
Can you help us understand, how do the fires stop? So the Bronx is not burning today, but what is it, a structural thing, or what should we be paying attention to today, given the scam that you exposed around insurance that I like didn't even know about?
Yeah, so you know, Bronxites figured out before anyone that these fires were being lit for profit. I tell the story in the book, one Bronx tenant whose name was Genevieve Brooks, and she lived in the Crotona Park section of the Bronx, and by the mid-1960s started to watch white flight just ravage the neighborhood. She started a tenant union to try to save her building, but realized that was kind of thinking too small. So then she tried to organize a block association, still like wasn't thinking big enough. So she resolved to start a neighborhood-wide organization specifically for youth. She called it Seabury Daycare. And this daycare center effectively became the kind of unlikely vanguard in this fight against arson. So she and the children in her care, you know, they had their ears to the ground. They noticed in the very early 1970s that there seemed to be a pattern to these fires. They seemed suspicious in some way. And so in 1973, she and, you know, the kids in her care started to keep data on these fires, where they were happening, when they were happening. And they were able to map this pattern. She brought her findings to the fire department in her neighborhood, and she was effectively gaslit. She was told, you know, oh, you're seeing things. These fires are being lit by junkies. They're being lit by vandals. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. But she was undeterred. She kept organizing. She eventually starts in another group called Mid-Bronx Desperados. That was a community development corporation, and keeps pressuring the city to take action. And there were dozens of other organizations just like that happening in the Bronx alone. If you look nationally, by the late 1970s, the federal government begins creating basically an anti-arson like yellow pages. They like list out every anti-arson organization across the country. And that Yellow Pages booklet is 160 pages long. There are so many organizations that are just proliferating across the country, whereas before 1970, say, there probably wasn't a single anti-arson organization, right? Why would you need an anti-arson organization before the arson wave? But ultimately, the book makes the argument that this sort of grassroots organizing, though it was like the catalyst for these various processes for stamping out the fires, grassroots organizing couldn't take the profit out of arson on their own, right? They actually needed state intervention in order to do that. They needed to pressure their policymakers in order to, you know, to act effectively, because the arson wave wouldn't subside until until there was no profit to be made, right? And so policymakers by the late 1970s did get on board. They passed various reforms. They started actually creating municipal anti-arson strike forces. They created various pieces of legislation like tax lien legislation, which basically enabled the state to collect back taxes from insurance payouts before the landlords could actually collect that money. And because so many landlord torch buildings were in tax arrears, it actually made it harder for landlords to then turn a profit. So there were all these different mechanisms that came together. They also shamed insurance, the insurance industry itself, right? Which actually played a huge role. You know, insurance, it turns out, is pretty vulnerable to bad optics. So once insurers realized that they had a PR crisis on their hands, they actually got on board. They actually started really paying attention to which of these fires seemed to be suspicious and you know, refusing to issue payments on those fires right away, right? They began actually really investigating and really sending out adjusters to look into these fires. And all of these various factors together by the early 1980s meant that the arson wave had effectively ended.
Boom. Now, we are coming up on time. I cannot tell people to read this book more. I'm a huge fan and people need to read the book. Where do people go to stay in touch with you? Is it like Instagram? Is it Twitter? Is it the website? Is it, where do people, whatever you do next, they need to know about it. How do people stay in touch with you?
Thank you. That's so kind for you to say. Yeah, I'm on Twitter most prominently. I'm also on Instagram. I'm a professor at Temple and my website is freely available. I really encourage folks to get in touch. I've actually had received really incredible letters from folks who survived these fires, who I hadn't previously met. Buildings that I write about actually got in touch. So I actually really read the letters that come in and I usually respond. So I'd love to hear from you.
What's your Twitter? Can you tell them?
It's at Bench Ansfield.
Okay, boom. Well, this again was an honor. I'm happy that we got to do a teaser for the book, but people buy the book, read the book. The book, if you can imagine, is even cooler than this interview because the book is that good. We consider you a friend of the pod and can't wait to have you back.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.